I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 1st of October. Our guest this hour is a senior scholar at the Woodrow Wilson Center, and she writes a very, very important piece in Viewpoints, which is a publication of the Wilson Center. It is titled, We Bomb ISIL, and Then What? She goes on in a lengthy opinion piece to say the U.S. does not control the political situation in either Iraq or Syria. There are far too many actors that need U.S. support but do not feel beholden to it. Certainly the Kurds in both Iraq and Syria, also the government in Baghdad, probably are as dependent on Iran as on the United States. The Syrian regime is not going to listen to the U.S., which has called for its overthrow. Regional coalition participants have disparate interests, disparate perceptions of the level of the threat and where it comes from, and different goals. Marina Ottaway is our guest this hour. She's an analyst of political transformations in Africa, the Balkans, and the Middle East. And her current project is looking seriously at the countries of the Arab Spring and Iraq. She spent 14 years at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, where she launched the Middle East program. She has taught all over the world at Georgetown University, the Johns Hopkins School for Advanced International Studies, American University at Cairo, the University of the Witwatersrand at South Africa, University of Zambia, and Addis Ababa University. She is the author of Getting to Pluralism and Yemen on the Brink, and many other books as well. And we'll be talking this hour, asking some of the questions that nobody seems to be answering. Congress isn't there to debate the issue, and the president hasn't been very forthcoming on a political strategy that will accompany military action in Iraq and Syria. So I think this is an important conversation. Her piece for the Wilson Center is really good and very thorough. We have posted it on our Facebook page. If you have time, it's worth a read. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Marina Ottaway, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
As I was reading your wonderful piece, I was thinking, oh my gosh, the levels of complexity in this are just astounding.
Yes, I think you are absolutely right on that.
So why is it that nobody seems to have looked at what a political strategy may be after military action? Are we just used to bombing? Do we not have the analysts in place to tell us what's going on politically in each of these countries?
I think there are two reasons for this. One is that we intervened very quickly. In other words, after hesitating for months about whether to intervene in Syria or not, the Obama administration reached the decision to do something very, very quickly. And I think for good reason, because at the time they decided to intervene, ISIL was essentially walking across northern Iraq, and nobody seemed to be able to stop them. So that there was a need to do something on the ground militarily very quickly. The second reason why we are not, we don't have a political strategy is that the United States still appears to be wedded to the concept of what the Iraqi state should be like that they used after the intervention in 2003, where they were trying to rebuild Iraq as a democratic society with a strong federal government. One of the criticisms of the U.S. is that the Iraqi constitution creates a too weak federal government, puts too much power in the regions. So between the fact that we have the wrong model of the Iraqi state and we intervene too fast, this explains the lack of a strategy. Let me add that we don't even have a concept of what the Syrian state would look like. Whether it's the right concept or the wrong concept, we don't have a concept there.
Do you have faith, Marina, that an inclusive government still might emerge in Iraq?
It's not a question of an inclusive government in the sense of a government in Baghdad that that has some Shia ministers and some Sunni ministers and some Kurdish ministers, which the minorities are represented. The question is to provide the various groups with a reason to fight against ISIL. And at this point, the Sunni minority does not have an incentive to fight against ISIL because they have been very badly treated by the Baghdad government, despite the fact that there were always Sunni ministers in the government. But it's but yet they got a very bad deal. And at this point, there is no confidence on the part of the Sunni minority that they are going to get a better deal in the future.
You write in your piece that the Kurds in both Iraq and Syria seem to be the ones who are fighting with greater determination than the Iraqi army is, but you say here that they're probably fighting for Kurdistan more than for Iraq.
Yes, I think there is no doubt about that. The Kurds in the two situations are a bit different. The Kurds in Iraq already have an autonomous region, and they put the government, the Baghdad government, on notice a few months ago that unless a solution to the issue, to some outstanding issues, including the export of oil, and maybe we can talk about that later, but unless a solution is found to those problems, they are going to hold a referendum of independence. So the Kurds in Iraq, it's, if you want, can smell in the possibility of independence near. The situation in Syria is quite different because the Kurds there don't have an autonomous region, have never been recognized any rights by the government in Damascus, and at the same time they are very close to the Kurds who are fighting for autonomy or for independence within Turkey itself. The group that is in power in Syria, the Kurds who are in power in Syria, in the Syrian, in the Kurds enclaves there now, is very close to the PKK, which is a Kurdish nationalist organization, which the United States considers to be a terrorist organization.
The other question that you ask, and the president seems to, he was asked this, I think, as well, and answered that it was a very good question, but you write in Syria the situation is much worse. As long as Assad is in power, there is no point of talking about an inclusive government. U.S. intervention is strengthening his position. The idea that it is possible to fight ISIL without strengthening Assad is fiction.
Yes, and I think we see this because the Syrian government had to fight against ISIL. He had to fight against the other radical organization, Jabhat al-Nusra, as well as against the Free Syrian Army. The United States has removed one front for them in the sense that now the United States is fighting ISIL, giving a chance to the Syrian government to go after the other organization. So we are strengthening his hand.
Mm-hmm. So in terms of having some plan after we finish a bombing, what it is we're supposed to do about Assad, we're depending perhaps on the Free Syrian Army to move in and take control here. But the Free Syrian Army, first of all, tell me who they are, how strong they are, and if they are indeed capable of doing that, and if that's our hope.
Yes. Well, what we know for sure is that they are very divided. They have never been able, they and the political organization backing them, are not able to rally behind one leader. They keep on having reorganizations and internal squabbles. On the ground, in terms of fighting against Assad, they have accomplished very, very little. The groups that really have been fighting against Assad are first Jabhat al-Nusra, which is a derivative of the Al-Qaeda, and then later ISIL. But the Free Syrian Army has not done anything. There is a plan in place by the United States to train up to 5,000 members of the Free Syrian Army, probably in Saudi Arabia, but Americans training these Free Syrian Army troops. But the estimates that I read is that the U.S. military believes that it may take 1 year to train these people. And, you know, the battle is now. Mm-hmm. So that essentially it seems to me that by the time they are finished training them, God knows what will have happened in the country.
What about the bombing? Has it succeeded or will it succeed? And if so, how long will it take to really weaken ISIL?
Well, I'm not a military strategist. What I see is that the bombing is bringing about results in those places where there are ground troops that can take advantage of the space that the bombing has created. For example, the Peshmerga, that is the fighters, the Kurdish fighters from Iraqi Kurdistan, right? Mm-hmm. They have been able to take over the Rabia crossing, for example, between Iraq and Syria, taking advancing on the ground after the U.S. had helped from the air. The same thing, the Peshmerga and some Shia militias are beginning to regain ground from ISIL around Kirkuk. Again, the U.S. helps from the air, and the ground, these ground forces advance. Where I don't see any sign of much of a success is where you don't have ground forces that can take advantage of the bombing in order to do something on the ground. Because in the end, ISIL has to be defeated on the ground. It's occupying territory and somebody has to take that territory away from them. And you don't do that from the air.
Mm-hmm. The president said fairly recently, Marina, that the intelligence community in this country had underestimated the strength of ISIS. How can you underestimate the strength of this organization where you've poured billions of dollars into counterterrorism since September 11th?
Well, you know, I don't know what was going on, but what I think has happened is that nobody expected ISIL to move so quickly from terrorism, from conquering territory. In other words, we knew that ISIL was very active. They were setting off bombs everywhere. But I think what caught everybody by surprise was the fact that at one point they decided to become an occupying army. And that's a big change in the strategy of an organization that essentially had been a terrorist organization until then. Terrorists don't occupy territory usually. That's not the way they operate. So I think what caught everybody by surprise is the swiftness of this transition of ISIL in Iraq from being a terrorist organization engaging in hit-and-run operation from actually seizing territory.
Mm-hmm. And able to get a whole lot of money to hold on to power, right?
Yes. Yes, because by holding territory, they are able, first of to do a number of things. They are able to extort payment from local businesses and so on for protection. There is a lot of money that local populations in ISIL-controlled territories have to pay up. And also they have been able, both in Syria and in Iraq, they have gone very strategically against the oil installation, oil fields, so that now they control a certain number of oil fields, both in Syria and in Iraq. These are not huge oil fields. They are not the giant oil fields that make the wealth of the country. But it's enough for them to want to supply their own needs because they have cars, they have trucks and so on, so they need gasoline, and two, to smuggle some across the border into Turkey and therefore get additional revenue that way.
Mm-hmm. Underlying all of this is this question of why people are motivated to join ISIS, to join ISIL. The president has talked to young Muslim youth saying that this is not what the religion says. Secretary of State Kerry, as you mentioned, says that there will be a major effort to reclaim Islam by Muslims. You write that the U.S. cannot be part of the effort to reclaim Islam from ISIL, and that also is a fairly complicated story, isn't it?
Yes. I think to me, the way we understand why the United States cannot be directly involved in this attempt to reclaim Islam is just imagine what the reaction in this country if the Saudi government declare that it's going to help the Americans reclaim real Christianity. I mean, you know, there would be a total, there would be complete outrage. So the United States is predominantly a Christian country. It's certainly, sure, we have minorities, there is the religious tolerance, but we are predominantly a Christian country and the Muslims are a small minority. So that the idea somehow that the United States could play a role in the reclaiming Islam and in teaching Muslims what true Islam should be like, even if we do it by backing, clerics and so on, it's preposterous. So that I think would be very well advised to let others fight that fight. The problem is that the countries that are more likely to fight that fight and to claim legitimacy in doing so, for example, Saudi Arabia, which is, after all, the place where Islam originated. The king of Saudi Arabia calls himself the custodian of the holy mosques, the most sacred sites of Islam. They have a degree of credibility in reclaiming Islam. The problem is that what they uphold is a very intolerant view of Islam. Saudi Arabia, it's not a liberal country. It does not interpret Islam in a liberal way. There is only one school that is acceptable to them. It's a very conservative school. And everybody else is a heretic for them. So that's not a very good, a very good way to reclaim Islam.
So how is that done? I mean, who's supposed to take on that task? Who can take on that task and be fair and inclusive?
I don't think there is any one organization, any one country that can do it, as there is no one country in the world who can speak in the name of Christianity.
Right.
I mean, the Islam, like Christianity, is a very complex religion with many different branches, with many different interpretations. There is nobody who can speak in the name of all of them.
You mentioned Saudi Arabia being a pioneer in the attempts to re-educate young people who are attracted to radical Islamism. What have they done in that regard?
Well, they started, it goes back many years, because they really started with the young people who had gone to Afghanistan, what used to be called the Afghan Arabs. And this is, way back before the US invasion. And when they started coming back, and you have to keep in mind that Saudi Arabia keeps very close tabs on its population, so that they knew when they were coming back. And some of them were, some of them went to jail and they were kept there because were deemed too dangerous. But a certain number of them, after a stint in prison, were sent to these training camps for rehabilitation, where they get a mixture, and it's a very comprehensive program. I mean, it's only a country like that has, the amount of money Saudi Arabia has can do it. It's a mixture of religious education, psychological evaluation, and corrective measures, more preparing them for jobs, letting them do a lot of sports, working with the communities to prepare them, the families and the communities, to accept this young people back, but also to keep an eye on them. And it goes as far, for example, in many cases, to get them married before they, so that they, once they get released, they are part of a family.
Mm. We're going to welcome phone calls for you, and we'll do so in just a moment. Our guest this hour has written a very, I think it's an important piece, and covers so much territory. We bomb ISIL, then what? Marina Ottaway is senior scholar at the Woodrow Wilson Center. This is a piece that she wrote for the Wilson Center Viewpoints, and it is on our Facebook page. I think it should be read by everybody. It's very good. It's asking the kinds of questions with the background information that she has, and it's extensive on this part of the world, and you wonder why this isn't more a part of the national discussion, which it seems to me should be taking place. at a pretty serious level. Marina is senior scholar at the Woodrow Wilson Center. She's an analyst of political transformations in the Middle East, the Balkans, Africa, and she's currently working, as you can tell, about the countries of the Arab Spring and Iraq. Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're also on Twitter at Kay Dunn Show for questions you have or how you would answer this question. We bomb ISIL, then what? Do you feel as though we have a political strategy? Do you think we need one? What do you think of our efforts so far? We'll take your phone calls in a moment. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Let's go to phone calls now for Marina Ottaway, senior scholar at the Woodrow Wilson Center. We start with Carl in Madison. Hi, Carl.
Yes, hello, and hello to your guest. Just listening to the conversation, now I am no expert in this field, but the parts that I do know, I hear the guest making point after point after point that makes good sense, that sounds sound, that fits together. And yet I listen to our national leaders and their perspective of, well, how could we have known about ISIL and its strength, and it looks like we'll have to bomb again. She might have named her article, we've bombed Cambodia, now what? Or we've bombed Afghanistan or Iraq, and now, you know, in Syria, now what? And the now what part, it strikes me as just an American citizen trying to follow all of these complexities that we are either incredibly inept over and over again, which I find it very difficult to believe with all of the money and all of the arms infrastructure at stake, or we are perfectly happy to continue to maintain simmering issues all around the world as long as there's ways for our armaments to continue to be used and build more and make more money for those that build bombs. And please, perhaps your guest can help me become less cynical, but I have a very hard time believing that we are as inept as we appear to be.
Thank you, Carl, for your call. Marina.
Yes, I think, Carl, perhaps you are a bit too cynical. I mean, there is no doubt that there are, you know, the armament industry is making money on all these wars. But frankly, I don't think that's why we are going to war. And I don't think we are extraordinarily inept. It's just the fact that it is not easy to solve the political problems of another country. In other words, what the United States has tried to do, for example, in Iraq and in Afghanistan. You remember we used to talk about nation building. We are going to reshape the political systems of these countries. We are going to create new countries. It just cannot be done from the outside. I think there is perhaps this excessive American optimism that it can be done. We learned a hard lesson in Afghanistan and in Iraq, and nobody's talking about nation building at this point. But the fact is that it is the task itself of finding a political solution which is overwhelming. The United States has a huge advantage over all other countries from the military point of view. The U.S. military is much stronger, much better organized, but much better armed than anybody else. But when it comes to the capacity, you know, to the political side, we really don't have any special advantage over other countries.
And yet, his point and your question that you write in this very important piece, the fact that we don't know, and putting together the what in the after we bomb is such an incredibly difficult thing to answer. It is, to me, pretty unbelievable that you don't have the finest minds in the country, people like you who are sitting around the table talking about what a political strategy would be, what's possible, what's not possible, considering the complexity of the region. I mean, that is dumbfounding.
Well, the problem is that we cannot make it happen. In a moment of hubris, I can tell you, you know, I can probably design you a political system of Iraq, which I think has some some chances of success, a system which is very decentralized with a lot of regional autonomy and so on. But even if we had a clear idea, even if U.S. policymakers themselves could agree on what the state should look like, the problem is we cannot make it happen. Only the Iraqis can make it happen, and they have to agree among themselves. And we cannot force them to agree among themselves. And we can depose a tyrant, as we did with Saddam Hussein. We can try to contain a movement like ISIL. We cannot make people, the government and the people of another country, make the decisions that we think they should be making. That is the difficulty.
Marina, you write in the piece, for the United States, ISIL is the greatest danger. For regional powers, ISIL is a danger, but not the major one. And joining in the fight against ISIL could have serious domestic repercussions. There are probably active cells in all of these countries, and many ordinary Sunni citizens sympathize with the organization. Which, you know, you read that and you say, really? Well, how are we going to persuade any of these countries then to fight this important fight, which really is their fight and not our fight?
Well, that is certainly a problem because, for example, Saudi Arabia, the government of Saudi Arabia is totally against ISIL, not because they are the puritanical, not because of their brand of Islam, which is not that different from the interpretation of Islam in Saudi Arabia, but because they are political. The Saudis have reached a bargain with the Sunni clerical establishment that they can have religion and they can have social customs, but they have to stay out of politics. ISIL is in politics, and that is absolutely, it's a non-starter for the Saudi government. But a lot of Saudi citizens like the idea of this movement that they see sort of reviving the glories of the jihad, reviving the glories of the past. Are they misguided? Sure, they are misguided. It's a reality that there is a lot of sympathy. There was a study done about the users of social media in Saudi Arabia, and they're mostly young people, that showed that over 90% of the users of social media sympathize with ISIL. They are not a cross sample of the population, but still, the presence of ISIL sympathizers is very real.
That's astounding. Thank you very much for the call, Carl. Our number is 800-486-8655. Jeff in Madison. Hi.
Yes. Good afternoon. This is critical. I was in Beirut in February and felt absolutely there was no problem. I Skyped today with a UN colleague who just moved to Beirut, and they are nearing lockdown because of ISIL. I have a question. This is my question. We keep talking about the religious tenets of ISIL, and yet my understanding is many of the members were the former Baathists from the Saddam regime who were basically forcibly retired from the army. They certainly were not Wahhabists. They were not super conservative Islamic sect. What role do they play, if any, in this? And is this about Islam or simply taking power back from the Shias? And once they do, does it calm down? I wonder.
Yes. No, you're absolutely right. Yeah, I think you have to make a distinction between the leadership of ISIL, the core leadership, which is highly ideological and embraces the form of Islam. And then those groups, and certainly they are very numerous in Iraq, that find are siding with ISIL in order to get back to the government in Baghdad, weaken the government in Baghdad that they feel has discriminated against them. They feel it's a Shiite-dominated government, Iran-dominated government, and therefore they finding ISIL a convenient ally against the government in Baghdad. Now, the problem, there are two problems here, is that, in the end, it's not clear who's going to win between ISIL and the former Baathist in Iraq. Right now, they are allied. One of the hopes of the United States and of the government in Baghdad is to be able somehow to offer enough to the former Ba'athists, to the Sunni citizens of Iraq, to convince them that this alliance with ISIL is not in their interest. I think there is a possibility of doing that, but what the government in Baghdad is offering Sunnis now, it's not enough to convince them that they should not side with ISIL. Mm-hmm. But it's a marriage of convenience, there is no doubt.
Sure. Thank you.
Thanks very much for your informed comments, Jeff. Madeline in Waupaca is next. Hi, Madeline.
Hi. I feel sorry for President Obama because American people seem to have forgotten that it was President Bush that took us into Iraq and destabilized the whole area for no good reason. And now President Obama is having to deal with the fallout from that. And the American people are war weary. They don't want to go back into war with boots on the ground. And yet there's people that are criticizing him for the air attack. But he had to do something because of the what they were doing to the innocent people of Iraq and Syria. And I'd like to know, your guest, what would she do?
Well, that's a very good question. I understand your comments, and certainly the problem in Iraq or in Syria was not created by the Obama administration. Certainly the situation that exists in Iraq now is very much the consequence of previous policies. When I criticize the policy of the Obama administration, I'm not saying that Obama should not have intervened. I think Obama was forced to intervene. As I said earlier in the show, ISIL was walking across the country, essentially, finding no resistance on the part of Iraq, and something had to be done to stop them. The problem is that they need to develop much faster than they have been doing also a political strategy. Because right now, it seems to me there is and probably this was corrected. The first order of business is try to stop ISIL, try to stop the advance before they go any further. But unless they move very quickly to devise a political strategy, what they are gaining on the battleground is going to be lost.
Thank you very much, Madeline, for your call. We have lines open if you'd like to join our conversation. Marina Ottaway is our guest this hour, senior scholar at the Woodrow Wilson Center. She knows this part of the world very thoroughly. She is currently doing a project on the countries of the Arab Spring and Iraq. She's taught all over the world and is an analyst of political transformations in the Middle East, the Balkans, and in Africa. And she's written an important piece we've put on our Facebook page because it's very thorough and it's background information that we should all have. We bomb ISIL, then what? It's a piece that she wrote for the Wilson Center Viewpoints. Here's our number. Join us if you would like. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. Let's talk a little bit about Iran. You also mentioned Iran in your piece. And Iran backing Assad, any help to him is also help to Iran, and there are lots of Sunnis, you write, including Gulf governments who are part of the coalition, who see Iran as a bigger threat than ISIL. Let's add another level of complexity to the whole situation.
Yes, because the problem, there is no doubt that the Arab Gulf countries, right? Iran is also a Gulf country, but the Arab countries that own the Gulf are terrified of Iran. They see Iran, it's a much bigger country, of course. They see it having aspiring to dominate completely the Gulf region. And, of course, Iran is a Shia country, while the Arab Gulf states are predominantly Sunni, so there is the problem of, you know, sectarian differences between the two. And they insist that the United States should not just focus on the problem of what they call Sunni terrorism, that is ISIL, but they should also focus on the problem of Shia terrorism, and by that they mean the policies that are followed by Iran and are followed by Hezbollah and other allies of Iran. The problem is that the Gulf countries also want the United States to negotiate a nuclear deal with Iran because they don't want a nuclear-armed Iran on their doorsteps. So on one hand, they want the United States to negotiate with Iran on the nuclear issue. On the other hand, they would also like the United States to take a very firm stand against Iran and the policies it's pursuing in Iraq, in Syria, in Lebanon, and so on. And I think it's very difficult to do both at the same time. It's very difficult to negotiate on a country and crack down on it at the same time.
Let's go to John in Algoma. Hi, John.
Hi.
Hi, John.
One of your former callers asked, what would your guests do? What are the elements of a solution? It's easy to sit back and criticize all of the things that have been done, and probably given the West's dependence on the Middle East for oil, we're not going to leave anytime soon. So what are the elements of a real solution? What needs to follow up behind the military actions that are being taken now?
Well, I think what is needed is the government in Baghdad, you know, encouraged by the United States, needs to make sure that all its population groups have an incentive to work together to defeat ISIL. And at this point, it's not happening because even with the new government that was recently formed in Baghdad, there is still no evidence that this government is offering an incentive to Sunnis and Kurds to work for a common cause. Let me give you an example. It's extremely important to the Kurds to maintain a high degree of regional autonomy. And this is also accepted by the constitution. There is a formula for dividing the oil revenue among the various regions of the country. The government in Baghdad has not paid Kurdistan its share of the oil revenue since last March. Okay, this does not give an incentive to the to Kurds to fight not just for Kurdistan, but for the rest of Iraq. So that the United States needs to bring pressure on this government to really become inclusive in the real sense of the terms, not that you have two Kurdish ministers in the cabinet and three Sunni ministers in the cabinet, but really pursuing policies which are discussed and agreed upon with other with the minorities in the country. The same concerning the Sunnis. The government is not, Baghdad is not offering the Sunnis anything at this point.
Well, they've had a long time to sort of figure this out, haven't they? You're not saying anything that the Iraqi government shouldn't have known some years ago.
Well, yes, but unfortunately, the United States is partly responsible. The United States backed Nouri al-Maliki, the previous prime minister, for two terms in office. And Nouri al-Maliki was supported, paradoxically, not only by the United States, but also by the Iranian government. And the policies of the Maliki administration were extremely pro-Shia. They were eliminating from the command, important position in the army Sunni officers, for example, which is one of the reasons why this politicization of the chain of command in the military, it's one of the reasons why the military collapsed and so on. And the United States knew that this was going on. Everybody knew this was going on. But the United States decided for many years not to rock the boat, to let it happen. And now, again, they're hesitant in really taking a firm stand against what continues to happen in Iraq, because one way or another, they feel that they still need this government.
Marina Ottaway is our guest this hour, senior scholar at the Woodrow Wilson Center, wrote a piece that caught our attention. It's on our Facebook page. We bomb ISIL, then what? Our phone number is 800-486-8655. You can send an email if you'd like to do that. John, thanks for your call. That's talk at WPR.org. Our Facebook page where you can read her article, which is very, very good, is the Kathleen Dent Show. And this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, back to phone calls. We have many of them. Miriam in Milwaukee is next. Hi, Miriam.
Yes, I would like your guest to address two things. I think one of the things that the United States and other Western countries have made a grave error in terms of dealing with the Middle East is the refusal to acknowledge that their psychology, I don't have a vocabulary for it, is different from that of the West. We see democracy, having a republic as the end-all, be-all, and I don't think that the West really understands that it may not be that way for Middle Easterners and the people of Middle Eastern countries. The other thing, having lived in the Middle East, and it's something that I observe, is it seems like these groups like ISIL and whatever are very fearful of professional, educated people. And I'm going to add this, especially women. And I'm wondering, how can we assist Muslim women to take the power that they really should have? I believe they can create the change if only they had the wherewithal. I'll hang up and I'll listen to your answer. What a great program, and thank you to the speaker.
Thanks, Miriam, for the call. Marina.
Very interesting questions. Let me start with the second. I think Arab men tend to not just fundamentalists, not just Salafists, but Arab men in general are fearful of educated professional women. It's pretty widespread in the world. On the other hand, I don't agree that Salafists are these radicals are afraid of all professional people. One thing that all studies have shown, if you look at this radical Islamist organization, they have a very high number, or an interestingly high number, of well-educated people in their leadership. And they are all people educated in the hard sciences, in the natural sciences. They have a lot of engineers. They have a lot of doctors. They have a lot of the head of Al-Qaeda now, Zawahiri, is a medical doctor, for example. And this is very, very typical. So it's not that they are necessarily ignorant people that have not been exposed, you know, that don't know best, is that they are really committed to certain ideas. I mean, in a sense, there is a parallel here. The leadership of communist parties was always extremely well-educated intellectuals who should have known better, but, certainly had been exposed to different ideas. Now, promoting women to try and counter these radical ideologies, I'm not sure it's a feasible tactic or strategy. I think it is important to promote women as much as we can. But again, I think it is important to keep in mind that it is Arab women who have to fight those battles, because they understand their society and how to fight those battles infinitely better that we do. And we can help them. We should ask them how we can help them. I'm always struck. I travel a fair amount of Saudi Arabia, for example. And Saudi Arabia is a place where, you know, I really find a great deal of trouble functioning, because there are all these restrictions of what women can do and not do. And I'm always amazed about how professional Saudi women find a way around those restrictions. And they are going to be the ones who are going to make the difference in the society, not the West, not what the West can do from the outside. Concerning the other more general question about the cultural differences between between the West and Arab countries. Certainly there is no tradition of democracy in Arab countries. There are a few exceptions. There have been periods of reasonably democratic rule in Egypt in the 1920s and 30s, for example. There has even been a period of relatively democratic rule in Syria, more or less in that period. We always forget about it. Certainly, it's not the dominant ideology now. But after the Arab uprisings, what has been called the Arab Spring, it is quite clear that there are people in all the Arab countries that really would like to live under a more democratic system, who do believe in political participation, who do believe in human rights. Problem is that they are against governments that don't want to surrender power. And this is an old story. The West went through the same experience in the past. That's why most of democratic transformations in the West were preceded by a period of violence.
Thanks for the call. We go to Dave in Elkhorn. Hi.
Hi. I was curious about, it seemed to me that Assad had come to power. He was educated in the West, lived in the West for decades, as far as I know, practiced medicine in Britain. It seemed to me that there was an abundant opportunity here for some sort of a rapprochement with Syria, with whom I'm not really sure I see that we have any fundamental conflict with. They definitely have some problems with Israel, but, you know, it's a complicated world. Some things we can just work around. And now we're funding or supporting rebels in Syria who are supposed to fighting as our proxies against ISIS. That's all I had. Do you have a comment on that?
Thanks, Dave.
Yeah, no, it's a very good point. I mean, the regime of Assad, the way it was not now when he has unleashed ISIL and everybody else, but the regime of Assad before 2011 was not a threat to the United States. It was a threat to many of its own people. It was a very repressive regime, but it was certainly not a regime that threatened the United States. And in fact, Bashar al-Assad's father, Hafez al-Assad, who was an extremely capable politician, was very good at always pulling back from the brink, provoking in the United States and then pulling back at the last moment and patching up the relationship. The problem that with Syria now started with the uprisings of 2011, when the many Syrians finally, inspired by what was happening in other countries, in Egypt, in Tunisia, and so on, also revolted against the government. And the United States took a disposition that Assad must go. Obama declared it very clearly, Assad must go. And once the United States made a commitment to that position, it also encouraged the opposition to go to war with Assad. And now it finds it in a very strange situation where it encouraged the revolt against Assad. It encouraged Syrians to rebel against it. They refused then to back them and to help them in any way because they were afraid that the more radical organizations would take over. So it has been sitting on the fence for all this, since 2011, until the threat posed by ISIL became such that it could not be ignored. And why it is true that the Assad regime was not a threat to the United States, ISIL could be a threat to the United States.
And thank you very much. Considering all that has to be done, just tell me in 20 seconds, if you could, what would be the outcome of just letting all the countries in the Gulf handle this, as horrendous as it is, by themselves?
Well, I don't think they're up to handling it. Maybe in the end the situation would got to be much worse. At the same time, the prospect of ISIL taking over much of Iraq, which certainly could have been the case without an intervention, it's a very frightening idea. And you can say, okay, maybe the Arab countries, the Gulf countries in the end will handle it. But what happens if they cannot?
Marina, thank you very, very much for your wisdom and your writing. Marina Ottaway, our guest, senior scholar at the Woodrow Wilson Center. Her piece, I urge you to read it. It's on our Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. We bomb ISIL, and then what? Thanks to KP Whaley for producing the hour, and to KP as well for on-air production here in our studios in downtown Milwaukee. What a complicated story this one is, huh? We'll be on it again in just a little while. Thanks for listening to this hour.